All right, again, we're going to be discussing page 2. I'll just make note of a couple of things that we talked about last week. If we get through this material, we will... I've got some material that I have been looking at on what we alluded to in our study last week, that is the controversy that exists with regard to the meaning of the days in Genesis chapter 1, as to whether those are having reference to literal 24-hour days or ages of time. There are some who are advocating that. Some, what do you call someone when they're a gospel preacher but they're teaching error on that particular subject? I don't really say so-called gospel preacher, but yes, they're teaching error on that particular subject, and we're going to
call them professors.
Well, actually, one of them was a professor that kind of did that at Florida College. But we're going to talk a little bit about that. But I don't think that we'll have time to get to it this week. It's a possibility. I've got some material already prepared, but I'll have it kind of in a handout format for you next week. We began by looking at the two theories as to how life came about. We read the Genesis account, which tells us that God created life in its various forms. Verses 11 and 12, 20, 21, 24, 25, 26, 27, the various types of life, both plant life, animal life, water life, as well as land-based life. And then finally, of course, in verses 26 and 27, that as the pinnacle of God's creative work, he created man in his own image, and how that contrasts with the predominant scientific theory of man's origin that is held to by the majority of scientists today, which is the general theory of evolution. And as we continue through our discussion of these things, we'll talk a little bit more about the theory itself and what difference is there between the concept of evolution. I'll just kind of as a teaser with regard to that, make note of what my geology teacher said as I was, I think it was my sophomore year in college. It may have been the second semester of my freshman year. But I took geology, and he wanted to assure us as a junior college professor in a West Texas town that he was not in any way striving to cause any problems with regard to our faith. We can have our faith, and that's fine. He said when he's talking about evolution, he's not talking about something that's destructive to your faith. He's talking about simple fact. All the word evolution means is change. And that's it. That's all it means. And so what we're going to talk about in this class is not something that's going to affect your faith. And then, of course, he began to advocate the general theory of evolution, which indeed is something that contradicts Scripture. We're not saying that things don't change over time, because they obviously do. And there are adaptations. What we're talking about is a change between kinds. You notice everything produced after its own kind. And that's a biblical term, but it's God's term. God has set barriers as to changes from one kind to another. And those things are not things that are possible. They are not things that are observed. They are only things that are postulated. So we'll make kind of those kinds of distinctions as we continue on in the lessons. But I wanted to start off with the concept of how life came about in the first place, because this is one of the primary problems with the theory of evolution, because evolutionists contend that God doesn't exist. I do recognize there are such thing as theistic evolutionists. We're going to get into that brand a little bit later. But by and large, evolutionists are secularists. They do not believe in the existence of God. There is no divine, supreme, outside agency that brings about life. That life came about simply through chance and a confluence of events and chemicals which brought about life in the beginning. And so the first thing we talked about is when, where, and how did life originate as per the evolutionary theory. The when was 3.5 billion years ago. The where, the most common hypothesis today, though it's by no means one that is settled on, is a deep sea hydrothermal vent. And the how is that, number one, simple organic molecules formed. Second, replicating molecules evolved and began to develop, began to undergo natural selection. That a part of that selection was that some replicating molecules became encased in a cell membrane. And again, I'm not exactly sure when the life began. It wasn't very clear as far as this definition at what point in time they considered it alive. But then some cells began to evolve modern metabolic processes, that is, develop DNA. DNA, because of natural selection, became the winner in the sweepstakes as to how cells would form and how life would come to be. And then finally, the cells began to group and become to specialize, so that you had like what we have now as brain cells and muscle cells, and you know they began to differentiate and specialize and congregate or aggregate to where you have multi-cell organisms that eventually, voila, it becomes us. That's the evolutionary model. And the concept of this is, if the circumstances were ideal for the development of these kinds of organisms, which is why the deep sea hydrothermal vent with its heat and density and those kinds of things, the fact in the water, if all of these things are exactly right, then it happened once, and after a period of time, 3.5 billion years, things have progressed to the point where they are now. So given enough time and given the correct circumstances, it could have happened that way, and that's the postulate that that they follow in their theory. So that's the evolutionary model. What we did was, in point number one, which is the middle of the page, talk about some of the problems with the model. And we're not going to go over them again, but we pointed out four of them, and that was found in an article that. And if you would like to read the article, by the way. There, out to the side of problem of the evolutionary model, is a relatively short URL that you could type in. You could bring the entire article up on your screen and read it if you would like. I'd like to go to the second page, because the second page has to do with statistical improbability. I want you to just to note that what evolutionists do is they utilize the immensity of time to make what would be basically a very difficult theory to accept plausible. That given enough time, these things can happen. The same thing is done with regard to the immensity of space. I think it's kind of interesting. I believe his name is Ernst Mayr, if I remember correctly. I don't know if he's alive, because this is an article that I read back in the 1980s. But Ernst Mayr, I believe, was a Harvard biologist. And it's kind of interesting reading. Very, very militant with regard to his atheistic evolutionary beliefs. But when he was talking about life, he was saying, when you hear about these scientists all postulating that because of the immensity of the universe, that it seems probable that there's life on other planets. He said, as a biologist, he said, I want you to understand that it's a bunch of physicists and astronomers that are saying that, not biologists. That we biologists know just how rare and how improbable the chance development of life is. And he said, trust me, there is not any life anywhere else in the universe. That it only happened once. That's what Ernst Mayr said. And I thought that was kind of an interesting thing, and kind of indicated just how he recognized how improbable it was. But he denies the concept of God, so he's required to, despite the statistical improbability of life developing, he's required. It's a matter of dogma. He has to accept that it did happen once, and because the other premise is something that's unthinkable. But if you think about that, because we've talked about it as the Hubble Deep Space Telescope has gotten up out of the atmosphere, they fixed the spherical problems with the lens, and they're able to shoot that stuff way out in the universe and get the images. We have been amazed at what's come back with regard to the immensity of the universe and how far back that they've been able to go with regard to the images. So the universe is an immense place with millions, maybe billions of galaxies. I don't know what the numbers are, but the physicist says, or the astronomer says, there's probably life somewhere out there. It's kind of silly for us to think. But the biologist says, or at least this one says, no, there's absolutely no way because of how improbable it is. Well, this particular argument from this particular article that was written by Brian Thomas discusses somewhat that statistical improbability with regard to the creation of a single cell. And so we talked about last week that cells are made up of the proteins, amino acids, those things that are the building blocks of the cells, and of course the DNA strand. So I want just to kind of read this very quickly, and we'll answer any questions. I can explain a bit further. But it says, the 2008 documentary movie Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed presented 250 proteins as an estimated minimum required for cell function. In other words, when you think about a cell, what do you think of? A little blob. And when you see the pictures in their drawings in the textbook, or maybe real fuzzy gray images from an electron microscope of a single cell. Now, I understand that some cells are big enough, the amoebas, paramecium, you can see them under a microscope. But when you look at that, you see something that to the naked eye or to the microscopic eye seems relatively simple. But science, because of the technological advances, has come to recognize that it is an extremely complex organism. So at minimum, this particular documentary movie back in 2008 said that there has to be 250 proteins working correctly in tandem for a cell to function, for a cell to be alive. And so the odds of that many forming by chance was equated to a man winning at a slot machine 250 consecutive times. Kind of put it in there just to consider the statistical probabilities. But in reality, what has happened with new research, it may be four times as difficult as that, because it says that new research suggests that there has to be a total of 1,000, not 250, but 1,000 different aspects that come together, and the confluence has to be that detailed in order for a cell to function. New research suggests 480 proteins necessary in addition to 532 other essential regions. I don't know what the essential regions are. I don't know enough about that, but that's the kind of idea. It's 1,000. So if that's the case, well, that's four times larger than the 250, but of course it doesn't mean that it's four times as more improbable, because probabilities rise exponentially as you consider the more complex. It's not it's times four. It's to the nth degree more complex than it was before in that regard. So under point B, the argument that the great complexity of life makes its chance development to be statistically impossible is one that evolutionists seek to overcome through large amounts of time, the 3.5 billion years. But it says such time is not nearly enough, and unlimited time in and of itself does not overcome certain fundamental problems, some of which that we talked about actually in our discussion last week. I thought that I had put down in that, it is. It's the very, very top of the second paragraph there. The real odds are much more staggering. Molecular biologist Doug Ack said, we're talking about something that's staggeringly improbable, roughly one in a trillion, 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 trillion.
Six.
I don't know how many numbers there
six
are.
Six trillions.
Yeah, but that's trillion trillions. So yeah. I think that's again exponential in regard to those kinds of things. So it's just something I want you to understand that we're not talking about. And again, I think I made an allusion to this in our discussion last week that understand the theory of evolution is actually ancient. I was reading some material today that indicated that it actually was first postulated in any form that is recognizable, that man evolved or that life came through evolution back, I believe it was either 6 or 7 centuries B.C. And there is a mention or two, possibly, even among Christian writers in the 2nd or 3rd century A.D. with regard to these things. There was a Greek scientist back around the time of Christ that postulated that men came from fish. And of course, that's, you know, that's a general view today that life evolved from the sea. So anyway, those kinds of things have been here. But you know, two things are present with regard to that. One is an explanation without putting God in the picture. In other words, a natural rather than a supernatural explanation. Secondly, as time has passed and science has uncovered more and more about not only the body and the complexity of the organs and their action of each organ, but also with regard to the complexity of the cell and the interaction of carbon-based life with oxygen and all the other aspects of our existence and ability to survive or life to survive on this earth or in this universe. The complexity, it's not become more easy to understand. It's made it much, much more difficult to explain how it could happen, that there could be especially with regard to the origin of life. The more we know, the more improbable it is. And that's something that the evolutionists cannot set aside, and they'll admit to that. The more we understand about life, the more complex. I mean, you even hear when you have on the Cosmos or Nova or National Geographic or Discovery Channel, and they're pontificating about the evolutionary process and everything. They will talk about the enormity of the universe, and they'll talk about the complexity of stars, and they'll get to life, and they'll be talking about the complexity of the single cell and how it's a marvel, and all of these kinds of things. They talk about the complexity, and then they'll start talking about Mother Nature, and they'll start talking about survival of the fittest, and those kinds of things as explanations of how it could have come about with that complexity. But the complexity is there, which makes the improbability very high. And I think that's something that indicates a real blind spot for them. Because when you're looking about the probability of one, and again, if someone wants to dispute the figures, and perhaps they would somewhat, but it's, we'll say ballpark, one in a trillion, 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 a chance of life, then 3.5 billion years doesn't cut it. I mean, it's, you know, I know that when we're talking about the deficit in the United States or the, you know, how much our debt is, you know, when it went from the 999 billion to 1 trillion, you know, that was, you know, now that's over a trillion now, but it's in the real low trillion still. I don't think it's got a 2 trillion yet, has it? I don't remember. Maybe it has.
It's over 18 trillion.
18 trillion, okay, well, all right. That shows you where I am. I don't watch Fox News and listen often enough for the go say. So 18 trillion, well, that's, you know, you can think about how many billions that is, since there's 1,000 billions in each trillion. So 18,000 billions, and we've got 3.5 billion years. So now you're talking about statistical improbability that is very, very significant. And it is a problem that evolutionists have been dealing with.
If you're having a hard time wrapping your brain around a trillion, you could look at it like this. If you count backward, 1 million seconds was about 12 days ago, a billion seconds about 31 years ago, and 1 trillion seconds about 30,000 BC, give or take a decade.
So there's a trillion number. I'm not sure if that helped, but it was very interesting. So yeah, we have a hard time wrapping our heads around numbers. So that's what I want you to do, is to think of it this way. The probability of life beginning by chance is a number that you cannot wrap your head around. It's just not possible to do it, and yet they postulate that it happened. Okay, so that's just an argument with regard to statistical improbability that I wanted to make note of, that I thought was something. Again, it helps us. Now, again, when you think about the lottery, for example, you know, the odds of winning are 1 in 250 million. Okay, yeah, but someone wins it. You know, I mean, not every time, but eventually someone wins it. And all it had to do is happen once. Now, I still have a problem with that. The fact that the very first time, and maybe the only time that it happened, that the events which followed continued to where it didn't die off. You know, it seems to me that the first time one little primitive cell popped on the scene and it's alive and is looking around, you know, that thing didn't immediately get snuffed out because of whatever reason, and then that was it. But, you know, that's my simplistic
mind. You're talking about linear probabilities instead of exponential probabilities. So like, what's the chance that I'm going to roll a 1 on a 6-sided die? Well, that's 1 in 6.
Right.
What's the chance that I'm going to roll a 1 on a 6-sided die and then roll another 1?
I don't know.
It's 1 in 36.
Okay.
So...
I thought that, but that's as far as I'm going with it.
So, the question is, okay, well, how likely is it that you're going to roll 2 1s? It's pretty unlikely. And people do it all the time. All the time.
Yeah.
So... you keep expounding that, and you do still end up with that same thing. You know, what are the odds? The odds are really low, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen the very first time. And it's still stacked. So that first cell appeared, maybe he died. Maybe another cell appeared, maybe he died. Maybe that happened 100 times. And then that next one, he actually made it to phase 2. And then he died, so he had to go back to phase 1.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's how it keeps going, but it doesn't mean that it couldn't have happened the first time. That's why it's kind of weird talking about probabilities.
Well, but I understand that. I get what you're saying. But again, for it happening once, it is an exponentially low chance of that. And for it to be happening multiple times is something that's even more improbable.
Well, I don't think that the number that you cited is the chance of life happening once. I think it's more the chance of sustainable life happening once. I'll go back and check.
It may be. It may be. But regardless, big number. Okay, let's go to the second point, because this is another point that I want to make. And to me, again, you know, it's a... The section that's in boldface in the middle of this, the point 3 on law of biogenesis, is something I think is a significant one. When you're talking about biogenesis, that's the production of new living organisms. Where does life come from? And back during the time of Louis Pasteur, the belief is that life can originate or spring up spontaneously. There were views of that. Give you as an example the views that maggots spontaneously form from decaying meat, and that in fact was the origin of the simple experiment. I don't know why that word wasn't coming to me. The simple experiment that Louis Pasteur used to disprove it, because he got meat broth, put it in flasks, covered one of the flasks up, and he did this, of course, in repeated times under different conditions, but he covered up one flask with maybe some cheesecloth, and he left the other flask open, and maggots formed in the flask that was left open, but did not form in the flask that was covered by the cheesecloth. Well, why is that? Well, because the flies flew in and they laid their eggs in the broth that was open to the air. And so from that, those experiments that he proved something that has become what is referred to as a law. And again, with regard to their different levels, and these are scientific terms, and I think it's kind of interesting is that when you talk about the theory of evolution, scientists are very big about telling you, we want you to know what it means by theory. That it's not a mere guess or an explanation as to how it could happen. It's something that is verifiable by the various data we throw at it and the observations that we see that verifies it. So a theory is something like the theory of gravity, or is it the law of gravity? Okay. So there are other theories, but that are accepted as mainstream and such. And what they're wanting you to know is that a theory is much more than a hypothesis. A hypothesis is a guess. You make a hypothesis, then you go do experiments to determine whether a hypothesis is true or not. A theory of something is different. It's an explanation to explain the data around us or some aspect of the world around us that has been verified time and time again by the available data and by the models that they utilize as such. That's the claim with regard to the theory of evolution, for example. So what they're trying to do is tell you that this theory is much more substantial than what those creationists would have you to believe. That, they're just guessing. Much more substantial than that. It's much more than a hypothesis. It has reached that level of theory, which is, by the way, as far as it can go. It can't get to law because it's not observable. due to the problems of time. But there is a law. It's called the law of biogenesis, recognized as law, that the evolutionist says is a law, but it one time didn't happen that way. And that's what they're compelled to believe. So Louis Pasteur observed that living things come only from other living things by reproduction. Which came first, chicken or the egg? I can answer that one. Which came first, chicken or the egg?
Chicken
did. Every Christian knows the chicken came first. Chicken laid the eggs. But here are the spider legs eggs, which develop into spiders. I don't know why you use spiders to the chicken, but that's okay. So, that is, life does not arise from non-living material, and that's the position that's held by spontaneous generation. That's the position that's held by the evolutionists with regard to origin of life. There was something that was non-living material, and then it organized in such a way as to become living. That's spontaneous generation. A related statement is omnis cellula e cellula, all cells are from cells. And that's one of the central statements of cell theory. There's another theory that you should have. And of course, scientists observe cells. Where do these cells come from? Well, they came from other cells. Is that always the case? Yeah, it's always the case. If you got cells there, they came from other cells. That's kind of the thing that they're saying. So the term biogenesis was coined by Henry Charlton Bastian to mean the generation of a life form from non-living materials. However, Thomas Henry Huxley chose the term abiogenesis and redefined biogenesis for life arising from pre-existing life. So, basically, biogenesis at one time meant, the guy who coined the term initially, he meant, here is, this is some kind of materials, some biological stuff, and then all of a sudden life comes from it. That's biogenesis. But what it's been redefined as is life comes from life. So when you hear the term biogenesis today, it means life comes from life. If I exist, I know that it's because I'm the product of my mother and father. And you go back and you go back and you go back and you go back. And since I'm here, you go back through that period of time in every single case of the time before it was so as well. Life comes from life. That's the idea of biogenesis. But he chose the term abiogenesis. That's generation of life from non-living material. And I want you to notice this statement. The generation of life from non-living material, this is from that, I believe I took this. This is taken from the Wikipedia page with regard to the law of biogenesis. So this is the way they put it. I'm sorry, I got forgotten. I didn't look over it well enough as I thought this morning when I looked over this. He says, Thomas Henry Huxley chose the term abiogenesis. The generation of life from non-living material is called abiogenesis and has occurred at least once in the history of the earth or in the history of the universe when life first arose. So in other words, you have a law of biogenesis, but abiogenesis happened once. So what's the law? What's the law of gravity? You drop something, it hits the ground. If there's gravity. Now, it doesn't do it if there's no gravity. But if there's gravity, you drop it, it hits the ground. That's the layman's way of explaining it. Not the engineers or scientists, but the physicists. But you drop it, it goes to the ground. Every single time you're in a situation where you're in a gravity environment, without fail, never an exception to it, you drop it, it's going to hit the ground. Unless there's some competing force that... But we're talking about the simple force of the weight going down. Okay? There's no exceptions to that. Gravity, drop it, hits the ground every single time. There's never been a time where you drop it and it stays there. Not if it's gravity. It's a law. The law of biogenesis. But once, there was an exception. That's basically what they're saying is that we understand this, we look at it, we've never, ever seen it any other way. This is the way it's always been. Always demonstrated as being, but there is one time when you drop the ball and it stays there. That's what the evolution is saying with regard to life. Isn't that true? Wesley? Okay. The engineers scare me. They look at me and they... Maybe it's because of the simplistic way I'm putting it, but I'm putting it to where the rest of us can understand it. Okay, so anyway, I wanted to emphasize the law of biogenesis. It's getting a little warm in here. I think the air conditioner turned off. Any questions concerning the first 2 points there?
Yes.
Yes?
I mainly have an observation and or a thought. There's no question about it. But I, let's say that this life certainly happens, and I accept, you know, life somehow being started from this chemical substance. What amazes me is we have the utmost, the taking of life, but how does that evolve and eventually get around to our brains, which have been formed? That to me just seems impossible at that.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll give you life, but life going into someone's brain over billions of years? I don't think so.
Right. Well, we'll talk about that as well, because that's of course, another objection that we would raise is there a sufficient mechanism to explain with regard, again, to the complexity of life and the way that life comes, and of course, the concept that is most commonly stated is that mutation is the explanation as to how things can change and evolve to that point. And we'll talk about that some as we continue our discussion of the evolutionary process. But again, I just do want to emphasize the concept of life and its origin. Now, as a part of this, I've made the point of the teleological argument. And this is something we may revisit a little bit in a future time in this description. I want you to understand it in the simplistic terms, is that where there is design, there must be a designer. And so if you see evident design, then there must be a designer behind it. So is there evident design in life? And if there is, then there must be a designer of that life. That's the argument that is made. It's an interesting thing when you start talking about what is referred to as the teleological argument, there is a lot of objection that is raised to it. The first objection that is raised to it is philosophical. We actually talked about that just a little bit at the very beginning of our study of apologetics. And the philosophy gets really, really weird, and I don't want to get back into it. You know, I want you to understand that philosophers, they love to put in complex hypotheses and what ifs, and if this were so, then what about, and that kind of thing, to get to the point where, you know, if this is the case, then white is black, and black is white, and day is night, night is day, and it'll really blow your mind if you're not careful. But the objection that they make to the concept of the teleological argument, when you say it's evident, because I do believe that it is, I think the Bible argues that it is. The heavens declare the glory of God, the firmament shows His handiwork. But they say that's only if you presuppose the existence of the Creator. If there was no Creator, then you wouldn't be supposing that design necessitates a designer. And that just begs the question. But they were saying, what, in effect, in order for you to come to this conclusion, you have to already believe that there is a God, and which gets cart before the horse. Well, I don't want to even get into that. I think it's kind of silliness, because of the simple thing is that, you know, I understand there's a presupposition that somebody made this on our part. The reason why is because it's got screws, and it's got a cover, and it's got a lens, and it's got a motor, and it's got, you know, a cable and all those kinds of things. So I'm going to presuppose someone built it. But it's evident that someone built it and made it. And I don't see how you can philosophize that away, you know, the fact that that exists and it was made by somebody. Okay? So the second thing that the evolutionists will do is say that when you hear about this concept of design, there is the illusion of design that is the product of natural selection. That when things evolved, that some things worked well, and so they survived, and others didn't, and they so as time progresses and as all these mutations occur, then there is an illusion of design that is present. And there are problems with that kind of idea that we'll talk about in the future. But I do want to advocate the teleological argument in the remaining time that we have this evening, and note that that is the argument that the Bible makes. The Bible is not a biological textbook. It's not a scientific textbook by any means. But what it does argue is the evident truth that we exist and we function correctly, that the stars exist and they function correctly, that everything is in this equilibrium that allows the universe to continue, and that is evidence that there is a God. And I think it's a compelling argument. It's not necessarily something that's going to convince the atheistic evolutionist who is, you know, knee-deep in evolutionary hypotheses, but I think this is an area where we can pretty much, with regard to general man in the street, we can press on this matter to emphasize the reality of it. I was thinking about it just as an object lesson to bring my camera in, but I can kind of do that and explain it the same way I did with the projector. I've got a Canon. It's called a DSLR, and so it doesn't use film. It has a sensor, a light sensor that takes the images, but it has exchangeable lenses. It has zoom capabilities. It has multiple f-stops that open and close the aperture to adjust the light that comes in and that hits the sensor, or how much light gets in at any particular time. It has an adjustable shutter, which means the shutter opens and lets the light in for a period of time and then closes. And it does it more quickly, less light gets in. If it does it more slowly, more light gets in. And you look at that thing, it's mechanical, obviously, and it obviously had a maker. But the interesting thing is, the basis upon which that camera works is the same basis upon which the eye works. You have the retina of the eye as being the sensor. You have the pupil as being the aperture. And if you turn on the light in the middle of the night, you're doing this. You got shutters too, you know, as far as until you get used to it, because you close your eyes real quickly because it's so bright and too much light getting in, so you can squint. All of those kinds of things are there. All the mechanisms to create these images, moving in images, by the way. There are some DSLRs now that do have the ability to take videos. Unfortunately, mine doesn't, but they do have those. But if you were to ask anyone who's looked at the biology of the eye, and you can talk to ophthalmologists and optometrists about this, the complexity of the human eye is compared to a camera, as sophisticated as these cameras are these days, it's no contest how much more complex the human eye is. Not only that, but it's evident in the fact that when you lose an eye, they're not able to pop in a miniature camera that works. Now, they made headway with regard to those things, by the way, but they can't do anything to equate what you have when it's natural, when you have your eye. So the complexity of the human body, the eye being an example of it, is something that's absolutely amazing. And again, we recognize that camera had a designer and a maker. But understand this, it's made up of the same stuff that the human eye is. I mean, we're talking about atoms, and we're talking about a confluence of atoms, and they may be carbon-based rather than silicon-based or some other kind of base, but it's still atoms, and they're basically saying these atoms are organized in a particular way. You get a projector or a camera. These atoms are organized in a particular way. You get an eye, or you get a person, or you get some other organ. It's the same concept that's under consideration here. So I think the teleological argument is one that is very beneficial and helpful in explaining to someone, General Joe on the street, why it is that we believe in God with regard to the creation. And there are a number of passages that we've made note of, one that we already alluded to in Psalm 19. Actually, the first four verses of that text, the heavens declare the glory of God, the firmament shows His handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge, and there is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. And what that basically means is, it doesn't matter where you go in the world, it doesn't matter who you talk to, what language you talk to, it doesn't matter how remote their existence may be. They may be in the jungles of South America, they may be in the Sahara Desert, they may be in the United States of America, but everyone can look at the heavens and the testimony of the heavens because of the grandeur, because of the way it works, because of the way it is that God exists. Yes.
I think that's probably a lot stronger argument because you're arguing the positive side of the thing. You're arguing, you know, we believe that it was created by God because of these positive aspects that indicate that there is a creator, as opposed to trying to argue the negative aspects of this other thing that A, we may not even understand, and that B, if they can't really prove it's true, then it's hard to argue against things that they can't do because they don't have the substance there to do them. But it also leaves you just logically vulnerable to anti-probability tests. So there's plenty of things that are very unlikely, right? So if I go and I put a penny on my table, a quantum physicist will tell you there's a likelihood, there's a chance, I should say, there's a chance that that penny will fall through the table. Well, how in the world is that going to happen? Well, because there's this concept of quantum tunneling, and so an atom can go through something that's quote-unquote solid. How's that possible? Well, because there's a whole lot of empty space. There's this, if you look at the solar system, there's as much space in between going from the Sun to Jupiter's orbit as there is going from Jupiter's orbit to Saturn's orbit. You're doubling at that point. There's a whole lot of just nothing. Well, you see the little models of the atom that we have. There's a whole lot of nothing in us. Like, you're 98% water. Well, you're like 99.999% nothing. And so, why don't you just fall through things? If you're mainly nothing, then the table's mainly nothing, then the penny's mainly nothing, why doesn't it just fall through? And there's reasons. But those can be overcome. And so what's the odds? You go calculate the odds, and they're trillions of trillions of trillions, right? Well, what if one day they're doing their experiment and the penny falls through the table? Right? There's theoretically a chance. What if it happens? Say, wow, that was a lot less likely to happen than life evolving. We've got a pretty solid proof. Very unlikely things can happen. This is so much less likely than life evolving. Your argument that unlikeliness of life evolving is now irrelevant. So why even go and argue that in the first place?
So you don't like my statistical argument?
Go and argue. I do not.
Okay.
Go and argue from the positive side. Go and argue from the teleological side. Go and argue the way that your faith was built, right? Your faith wasn't built on the unlikeliness of science. Your faith was built on the likeliness of God.
I understand that. And I agree that the positive arguments are the best. However, I also will point out that the force of some of these arguments that we're making is a convincing thing to some people. So it may not be the best argument, but still a valid argument.
I'll say this really quickly. Yes, the teleological argument should be all you need for your average Joe on the street. It's not like we're going to bring the teleological argument to one of my brother's PhD professors that he's tutoring under. Okay.
I think it's still valid.
Yeah.
It's not a sophisticated argument. It's a general
Correct.
Broad argument.
But the thing is, what about that person who does know a little bit more? I mean, yes, you have to point out the absolute absurdity of their argument, because they're going to look at you and say, oh, you believe in that God thing. Okay.
Well, don't expect these arguments to convince them either.
No.
But I do understand what you're